Gotham Sports Network presents NYG Weekly.
NYG Weekly, back-to-back episodes coming at you. This episode, we are subbing out Nick for our good friend Will.
Great timing, by the way.
It's great timing.
Yeah.
At 27 on Twitter. You love him. You hate him. There's really no middle ground.
I was thinking about this.
Welcome.
He's an infamous Giants fan now, right? I think that's how you character. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. He's an infamous
Giants fan. Numerous players.
I was telling some friends on the beach, I feel like famous doesn't cut it. It's infamous.
Yeah, yes. Listen, there's some players on the team that love you. There's some players on the team that hate your guts. I'm sure the same can be said for some former administrative people in the front office. But we're some back.
Some members of the ownership family.
Yeah, probably. But anyway, listen, we're no stranger to controversy here. And let's get it underway. So Saquon Barkley back on a 1-year deal. Now, we spoke about this on yesterday's episode for quite a bit. Holy hell, did this man get bent over, spanked, and thrown to the side by Joe Shane. I mean, an absolute disaster class for Saquon. And I think yesterday we went detail by detail trying to figure out what his representation's rationale was in the negotiations, rejecting Joe Shane's offer after week 6, taking it to the offseason, thinking that they would get a deal. The running back market tanked. All of a sudden, he's staring down the barrel of double franchise tags. And now he's back on a 1-year deal, shows up to day one of training camp. And this deal is quite possibly the worst deal that you could imagine for Saquon Barkley. And by the way, this coming off the heels of the running backs union, the running backs Zoom call union. I think we need to workshop a clever name for it, where they were like, hey, we're getting fucked here. What are we going to do? And Saquon goes, I don't know. How about I go out there and take the worst deal possible? Weiss, do you have the incentives pulled up? So why don't you read off the incentives and we can sort of laugh and chuckle together at how absurd they are.
So it's a 1-year deal. Obviously, $10.09 million is the base. $2 million of that he gets up front instead of getting it throughout the season. $2 million of that he gets up front. The incentives are $909,000. That's the only new money in this deal is $909,000. $300,000 of that is if he rushes for 1,350 yards, which he did,
which he's never done,
right? Or he gets $300,000 for that. First of all these incentives are tied to the Giants making the playoffs. So he could hit these individual incentives. But the Giants have to make the playoffs. So $300,000 for 1,350 rushing yards, $300,000 for 11 touchdowns.
Which he's done once.
And $300,000 for 65 receptions. And
which he's done once.
Yes, but he's never done all three together.
Right.
It's important to note that the most important thing that we would think that would come out of any sort of negotiation would be, hey, we won't franchise tag you next year.
And he couldn't even get that.
And he didn't get that. And now Saquon shows up to camp. Will's favorite running back will be with the Giants for 2023 there. It wasn't really a chance that he would sit out games, but now he's back and he's throwing blue caps around at a lot of people again.
Well, a lot of people. Are you a lot of people?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Not me. No, he wasn't throwing it at me. I hope he wasn't throwing it at me because I wasn't
throwing blue caps that Mike Florio predicted. His article said, you know, he might would respond to like the suggestion with blue cap emojis.
Yes.
And that was prescient.
So
I have a little bit of a take. Yeah. I think I'm not sure I buy into the franchise tag being available for the Giants next year being a bad thing for him. I think the franchise tag for a running back in this market is quite generous. I think the fifth year option, frankly, last year is a significant investment relative to the comparable replacement cost. And that is kind of what brought me to asking for this discussion before, obviously, we knew that this news would be at the top of the at the top of everyone's mind. But running backs are really interesting because, as it's been discussed, running backs have a really important role in an NFL offense. But the difference between running back one running back and the next one isn't very substantial, as many, many instances recently have shown, and very, very few instances have disproved. So so I don't necessarily think it's as net negative as you know, as much as he lost as maybe everyone else does. I think this was really what was going to happen. I think most people, the long-term deals that people were looking at were kind of in line with what a couple back-to-back franchise tags would look like really anyway. I think he decided he wanted to be at camp. He wanted to save a little face and look and show that there was some victory in the contract. Both of that was achieved. Weiss, I'm with you. What you were saying yesterday, I felt that the Giants learning how to play without him, giving those reps around, distributing those reps around the younger guys in the backfield, I thought that would probably put the team in better position to compete. Not necessarily saying they're better without him, but saying that if they need him as much as some people, I disagree, but some people think they do, the best way to prepare for that is learning how to win without him and having him as a supplement, not leaning on him until that ultimately crumbles.
The reason why I think he lost is because I think there were a lot of better offers on the table throughout this entire negotiating period, dating back to the bye week. Like, people say Joe Shane won, but Joe Shane offered him a lucrative contract multiple times, and Saquon just declined. And he was 5 minutes away from free agency, so I don't necessarily blame him for declining the offer. But at this, in the same vein, it's like, dude, you have representation. Part of representing a player is understanding the player's market. Like, if I'm your agent, Will, and I'm negotiating a contract for you, I gotta know what people with your skill set are making and are going to make. If I don't, I'm setting you up to get bamboozled, which is what happened. Because the offers that were on the table, the reason they were taken off is because the Giants saw the running back market crumble. And they realized, holy shit, look at what's happening.
There are two parts of that. The Giants saw the running back crumble, and the Giants embraced a regime that cared about the reality around them.
Right.
And I think that pivot might have, I mean, I don't think it would have necessarily been unreasonable for an agent to underestimate that difference. I mean, we had a regime before this who, I mean, we can go all day about the missteps they had. They started the 2018 season. They said, okay, the last guy screwed this up, messed up the drafts. We don't really have a roster we can go with. We're going to sign the best offensive lineman we can possibly find, the only one on the market, Andrew Norwell. We're going to give him whatever price he wants, and that's going to do it. And clearly, as we've seen from what Norwell's careers look like, it's not like if the Giants had landed Norwell that, you know, the Pat Shurmur regime would have been a success. And then Norwell didn't work out. And immediately they said, okay, we have to set a record-setting contract for Nate Solder. That didn't work. We have to do something. This is something. We have to do this. And this regime operates in a very, very different way. They're elastic. They're saying, at this price, this is worth it. At this price times two, this is not worth it. And I think it may have been underestimated how much the Giants were willing to change to that, because there was a buck stops here number, clearly. And even the way that this process dragged on, it showed that Joe Shane was doing this the right way. I would have preferred a clean break. I mean, I don't think anybody who's had a conversation with me is surprised to hear that.
Why do you think a clean break was the right way to go? Because I think at $10 million on a one-year deal, I think I would take that for a guy that can, you know, that's as good as Saquon. I'm not necessarily saying you're wrong. I just want to know why, like, is your mindset just a running back that's making vet minimum or close to nothing? Or is there like a middle ground?
Well, first of all, when I say I want a clean break, this is the emotional fan who's been gaslit by an incompetent regime for 4 years about how this guy, didn't bleed blood, and you know, and was a superhero more than a running back. And frankly, it's an emotional decision because there is so much excrement from that regime on this legacy. And
you but know, isn't your emotions tied to the person that selected him, not the player?
Categorically. I'm not arguing with that. I'm not saying it's his fault. I'm not saying it's rational. But for me,
okay,
yeah, no, I'm saying my as an emotional fan, the legacy of the draft pick will always drastically overshadow the contributions of the player. And I, as you know, I unless I'm very specifically talking about something this player did, I don't use this player's name because I feel like using the player's name would distract and kind of deflect that it has nothing to do with anything this player's done wrong, that or, you know, as a player or a human being, that is why it's, you know, that is why that leads to my disgust. It's, oh, you know, we could have had a hot pretzel, hot dog, and bag of donuts. Who needs that? But we're going to start John Greco, who's about to retire, you know, on the offensive line. It goes on and on.
John Greco. I remember John Greco.
So there's categorically an emotional side to this. But at the same side, I think there's a real argument that the Giants kind of making a clean break from this kind of compete in a weak NFC for a playoff spot roster that might need to be rebuilt and retooled to really get to that next level. I think it's better to roll over some of this money than to pay some of these guys. I mean, you heard me. I thought we could have been priced out for Daniel Jones last year, and I would have been fine with that. Not because I thought we could have upgraded over Daniel Jones, but because I thought $40 million, essentially what he's getting, is really high from someone who I think can be really good, but has shown that he needs a lot to succeed. And I think there's a good chance that we regret. And basically, I was most concerned that this regime would be handcuffed by John Mara wanting to be applauded for a playoff season and not willing to take the hard times and thinking he was so close after last year and basically being told you have to do X, Y, Z because these guys are, you know, are going to make us better for the short term. What cost be damned. And I think, frankly, the way the process played out really assuages that fear, because I think we don't kind of put that that face so close to the stove if we're not serious about, you know, saying, you know, first comes first is this guy's star power and he needs to be and he needs to be protected and his legacy at all costs. Forget potentially trading down. He's here to play football, and I think that makes it a lot easier to get behind it at least.
So I just want to ask him one more question, Ethan. What is Saquon's value to you? Forget about what you just said about where he was drafted, but I'm saying if he's a free agent, what would you look at and say, that's a pretty fair deal? Because he deserves to be in the NFL, right? Like
Absolutely. Right. And he deserves to be taken care of somewhere because.
But what in your mind, what is like a rational contract value for him?
Well, I think that's a question that kind of gets to what this running back Zoom was about. And I'm sure, you know, we can open it up and hear a little bit of what Ethan has to say. But I think what Nick Chubb said was really more astute than almost anything I've heard on this topic in years.
Right.
I mean, you had last year going into last year, what drove me crazy. And I'm so underwhelmed by some of the, you know, the Giants coverage. I think, you know, the guys on The Athletic are great. Art's great. Connor's great. But there's a lot of content that makes people think they're informed and in fact are the opposite of informed. So last year, a common narrative was Saquon needs to show he's healthy to get a long-term deal. And I completely reject that. I think, you know, evidence has shown that the more somebody shows that they've been healthy for a full year, the more wear, especially if they're taking a full RB1 load, the more wear and tears on their body that can end up with an injury the year after. And you see that in trends. You don't see guys get 300 carries back-to-back years. Derrick Henry maybe being the one exception. And what Nick Chubb said was that running back is the only position where the more you produce, the more that hurts you at the negotiating table. And I think, you know, he hits the nail on the head. I think I would love to see a way that running back contracts are more tied to incentives. And obviously it's not just, you know, nobody believes that there's less correlation between an individual and an individual stats than, you know, some of the people on this call, I'm sure. But I think that that it's not, it shouldn't necessarily be about what he's going to do, because you pay somebody based on what they're going to do, not what they have done. Right. And I think, I think at this point, what he's going to do is less than what he did last year. I did not think that going into last year, but I think just after how hard he played last year, how much he took on pass blocking content, how much he created contact going for yards after carry. It's just really hard to do that, especially given that the season ended 2 weeks into the playoffs. You know, that's 2 weeks of a shorter offseason. So I guess, you know, that's a long tap dance. I think the answer to your question is if for a year like last year, maybe around the franchise tag of this year, that could be fine. But there's a really good chance, not I'd say because he was hurt in 2019 and 2020, but more because of the load he took on last year, that he's out by October. And if that's the case, you know, there's a chance that he's not worth a quarter of that. Obviously, he still needs to have his family taken care of, because if he gets hurt playing football, you know, that's his job, and he shouldn't necessarily suffer for that. But that risk has to be factored in. And I don't hear people who are saying the Giants offense needs him. Otherwise, they're, you know, I don't hear, okay, what happens if he gets hurt and now we have the money that's spent on him and we can't use it for next year? Ethan, how you doing?
I'm good. Well,
you know, I spent a lot of time today looking over your raving about Jonathan Beasley 2013.
He tiptoed that answer a lot. I mean,
Oh, please. No, I didn't. And you know what? Listen, you have no issue calling me out. So if you thought I was tiptoeing, you could have called me out.
I said Will was tiptoeing that question that I asked him.
Oh, got it. Okay. Yeah, fair enough. I don't see any upside.
Can we stop using tiptoeing with this guy? Last year, he ran into contact.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, good point. I don't see any upside for Saquon. Like, I genuinely don't think that he's ever going to get paid anywhere close to where he thinks or where he wants, partially because of the market and partially because of how badly his agents fucked up the midseason negotiations. I think it's really that simple. We went over the incentives. 1,350 rushing yards, he's never hit it. The receptions, he's hit once. The touchdown total, he hit his rookie year. Last year, he had 350 or so touches. For him to repeat that workload again, to reach numbers that he's never even hit before, I don't think that's even anywhere close to realistic. And on top of that, if he does get hurt, which is a very real possibility, then why would the Giants even exercise that $10 million franchise tag? Why? Like, okay, thanks for your service. Because if he gets injured and all of a sudden they realize that they can go running back by committee, which is what all the good teams do, then his value plummets because they're not going to pay him that $10 million franchise tag. And if he hits the free agent market off another injury, who's going to pay him more than $10 million? Who's going to give him more than a two-year deal? It's not going to happen. The guy is fucked.
The position is, you know, the position is, I mean, you have
the position is fucked.
who are so talented. I mean, and 25 years ago when I became a Giants fan, you know, obviously it's quarterback first and then running back second. But the quarterback was Dave Brown, you know, like Rodney Hampton was the guy. And it's just a completely different world now. And so what do you guys think is the future for the position? Like, what is the solution right now? Because I think we would all agree that it's not fair to running backs the way that teams can ask so much of them and essentially owe so little to them, because they're so, you know, there's another dime a dozen if the guy's not working out or if the guy gets hurt.
There is no real solution, not with this CBA. You can't do any like peripheral treatment like, oh, we're going to let, you can't franchise tag a running back. I mean, they're not going to do that, or you can't.
And this CBA is in place until 2030, so it's not like what you're going to get the entire players union to do a freaking holdout over one position that no one really cares about. It's not going to happen because quarterbacks are getting paid, offensive linemen are getting paid, DBs are getting paid, even linebackers are getting paid. Everyone's getting paid except for running backs.
I think there. What I thought was going to happen was. Thought there was an outside shot with these meetings and this sort of unionizing under a union, what the running backs did. I thought maybe Jacobs and or Barkley could have made a statement, but Le'Veon Bell made the statement, and Le'Veon Bell still got paid though, but he got franchise tagged twice, and on the second one he sat out. So I keep thinking to myself, what can they do? There's really nothing they can do because it is collectively bargained.
And it's like a double edged sword as well, because what the franchise tag is the average of like the top five at your position.
So it keeps going down.
Right, it keeps going down. So the franchise tag is just going to get worse and worse as the years go on.
Yeah, especially if we continue this path. I don't know of any solution. I do know all this, like people are saying, you know, make running back rookie contracts shorter, take away the fifth year option for running backs, don't allow franchise tags. Or if you do allow franchise tags, change the way you calculate them. I just don't think you can do that.
No, you can't.
Even if you negotiate a new CBA, I just don't think other players of other positions are going to be okay with that. Selfishly, they're not going to. So all this special treatment or this, you know, special guidelines for running backs, I don't see that. The next question is going to be like, does the trend change? Like, do two running backs get, you know, Nick Chubb like short-term extensions and they're worth it? And so teams decide, hey, we can win with having a running back that's making 12, 13, 14 million. And all of a sudden, the extensions you start to see for running backs is like 3-year deals, right? That could be an option. Another option I saw was like 2-year extensions with like a team option for a third year. Like I saw stuff like that being floated around, shorter extensions that give more upfront guaranteed dollars, but they're shorter extensions.
Only thing that would fix the market that isn't going to happen would be a serious scarcity of capable backs. But it's not going to happen because we see every year guys in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, undrafted, come in here.
Washed up Alfred Morris.
Yeah, listen, James Robinson, baby. Even if they only do it for a year, who cares? It's all you need. It's about the running game, not the running back. So, I mean, for the most part, obviously, like you're going to have special talents like Derrick Henry and Christian McCaffrey and so on. But for the most part, like unless your average running back is a guy who literally cannot hit the hole, is running into the ass of your offensive lineman, there's going to be no other way to reset the market unless there's literally zero talent available. And then all of a sudden, the top guys get paid.
That's why Barkley declining this deal is so mind-boggling to me, especially when they went to – this is the one thing I also don't understand. So the report came out during the deadline day of like how they went from 19.5 to 22.5, right? My question is, if they're guaranteeing you 19.5, that means they're going to guarantee you 2 years worth of the deal because they're not going to cut you after 1 year. It's not going to be a 1-year $19.5 million deal. They're not going to do that. Even if you get hurt, they're not going to do that. You know, they're going to guarantee you at least 2 years.
You become uncuttable.
Yeah, so let's say you do 2 years or 3 years, $36 million. That's $12 million a year, and you only guarantee $19 million, right? Or if you do 4 years, help me out, Will, 12 times 4 is what? 48. There you go. So let's go 4 years, 48, and $19 million guaranteed. Yeah, the guaranteed is low, but they're not going to cut you after 2 years. So you're going to get the $24 million at least. That's why it's so bizarre to me. Like, yes, obviously you want as much guaranteed dollars as you can get. And yes, you want the annual yearly salary to be a certain amount. But to me, it's the most years you can get under that contract is what's more beneficial. And if they're guaranteeing you slightly under 2 full years, 19.5, that sort of means they're going to guarantee you 2 years. And then when they went to that $22 million guaranteed, why did you not take it? Like, that's just, and all it took was a $900,000 incentive for you to come to camp
that he's not going to hit.
I think the last few years, the kind of base knowledge has really, really accelerated. I mean, you go fast forward, I guess, 5.5 years ago, 31 out of 32 front offices understood that it's more than a running back's highlight tape that makes an offense running. Unfortunately, we were that exception. And I think we, you know, obviously the draft happened. There's nothing we can do about it.
Move on.
It's hard to think about.
Keep going with your point.
I forgot to tell him we're not talking about 2018 draft.
When no, I told I, him, I feel like Phil Leotardo talking about Billy right now.
You I know it's killing me.
But so much of the conversation, you know, from the player selected himself about and the commentary about the pick was as if it was like some sort of critique about his ability. And like, you know, are people really doubting that I can play at this level? And it was just such a different conversation from what anybody who was talking about the pick was having. I mean, it reminds me of last year, and you know, I brought this up once already when I threw out that, you know, I thought that like rolling with like a Trubisky for next year for this year for like 6 million might be better than like DJ for what I thought would be like, you know, 25 to 30, not 40. People started saying, you think Daniel Jones is better? No, I think spending 6 million is better than 40 when that you're already going uphill with a roster that's still 2 years behind from the short-sightedness of the last regime. And this, I think this running back Zoom committee has really kind of opened some eyes into the reality of this NFL, you know, forget like, I think going back into even this bye week and some of the dialogue from last year, remember he was had the terrible 2021 coming back from the ACL injury. And he was saying, oh, I'm going to prove everyone wrong. Well, the only people he was proving wrong were the people who suddenly saw 2021 the year after, you know, he blew up his ACL, thought week one, you know, now that he's back on the field, he's a Superman. So he'll be, you know, hunky dory. And then we're heartbroken and, you know, perplexed that he couldn't do that and thought that all of a sudden he was washed. I mean, it was like this short-sighted, reactive, nonsensical narrative that he was out to disprove. It was never the running back juice isn't necessarily worth the squeeze. And I think if he could go back a year and a half ago or, you know, 6 months ago or 9 months ago, I guess, you know, to sign the tag, there's so much more wisdom in understanding how this works. And I think going forward, that these players are going to understand strike while the iron's hot, because that's not going to be around forever.
Do you think he's now, because I said this when the deadline passed, we did a pod. Do you think realistically he's playing for just another franchise tag?
I could really see this going in any direction. I think the team's success this year is probably the single biggest factor. I think if the team, after I finish this, I have a question that I want to ask you guys. But you know, if we make the playoffs, have a successful year, I think it's really hard. It's going to be really hard to move on with him, even if there are signs that he's in his last legs. I think if the team comes back down to earth and is, you know, having a 2-5 before the bye, there's a chance he might not be with the team in November. So I think all options are on the table. And I wouldn't even say if he gets hurt at the beginning of the year that he's not going to be back next year. I think all options are on the table.
What's your question?
Yeah, my question. I thought there was a question.
Yeah, this is the question. It's a little bit of a pivot. What would you consider a more successful season? Like running this 2022 season back essentially, and the same kind of thing happening, or not necessarily making the playoffs, but going like 4-2 or 5-1 in the division, and finally showing that we can play with Dallas and Philly.
Well, I don't think you can really show that you can play with Dallas and Philly and miss the playoffs.
Yeah, I think they sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah,
obviously, you know, it's a counter-correlated, you know, idea. But if you could pick one. What is more important?
Making the playoffs. I mean, I don't understand how that can play out. What do they win 6 games and 3 of them are against?
Well, 7. Philly, yeah, 17. Okay, well, that's actually the opposite argument. But yeah, I mean, they just lose out outside of the division because all of a sudden the NFC East is bad instead of being good or something like that.
That's a different story. If Philly and Dallas fall on their face and they finish with a subpar record, then. Obviously, I would rather make the playoffs, but I don't understand how, like, this is such a weird, Ethan, I don't know.
I don't know.
He always asks me these weird questions.
I don't get it. Listen, Will's brain works in mysterious ways. He's asking questions that make sense to him and not to everyone else.
Will, let me ask you a simple question.
Like Dallas and Philly could both go 11-6, going 1-1 or 0-2 against us. Like that's not completely out of the question.
I think it's out of the question. I just don't
see what I would. It's not what I would expect to happen, but it's possible.
Yeah, but on your flip side, sorry, I'm still trying to figure this out.
I know.
But on the flip side, though,
go ahead.
If it's the opposite, though, like if the Giants go 2-4 against the division. Like, it would take a lot
last year
for them to, yeah, and it took a lot for them to make the playoffs.
Right. I guess the reason I'm saying this is because I feel like personally, I am just so sick of being the punching bag of Dallas and Philly. I mean, it's, I think
this is my question for you. And I want
to hold on. I'll answer Will's question. Yes. I would rather do well against the division because I don't care about, like, I obviously care about team success, but like, I've been saying every podcast episode, it's not about last year, it's not about this year, it's about year three. So, like, this team, as currently constructed, is not a Super Bowl contender. So, like, yeah, making the playoffs would be great, but it's unrealistic to expect them to do anything serious just as it was for them to do anything serious last year. So if they were to just, like, show that they can run with Dallas and Philly, make themselves even more of an attractive destination for players, really finish rounding out that roster – don't roll your eyes at me, Weiss. But you really think Dave Gettleman and Joe Judge, they tarnished the allure of playing in Big Blue and in New York. They absolutely did. With a competent GM and an organization showing that you can compete against quote-unquote America's team and a team that just went to the Super Bowl with an MVP caliber quarterback and a good head coach, Weiss. Then,
well, they got pretty lucky.
Yeah, so did the Giants. So the listen, I don't really care. Show me that you're legit, and then I'll be happy. Because if they prove that they're legit, that means Daniel Jones is playing up to his contract, that the offensive line has improved, and that a lot of the defensive players that are young have taken the next step. To compete with the big dogs like Dallas and Philly, they gotta fucking step up in a big way. And I think that would make me very happy and confident going into year three that this team is going to make some noise in the playoffs.
Will, this timeline stuff, right? I think to some people, last year expedited that. To some people. Where I look at the NFC, right? And I say,
I'll tell you what. I don't care about most people. Joe Shane knows what the timeline is. And this offseason showed that he's sticking to it.
Well, actually, I would argue that he made a couple of compete now moves. I'm not going to say win now. I'm going to say compete now moves.
Such as?
Trading for Darren Waller, who's going to hit 30 and is one of the
sure, but listen, like sometimes these guys become available. Listen, like I get it.
I'm just saying. He's made some win compete now moves. I think
sure.
Compete now and win now.
Yeah, but it's also like filling big needs.
Will,
no, the timeline did not accelerate for me.
Okay, so where are they? What is this team right now in your eyes?
So Bill Parcells gets credited all the time with the quote, "You are what your record says you are."
Don't beat around the bush with this. Just answer. I want a straight answer with you.
Give me 30 seconds to set up.
Okay, all right. But Bill, I don't want to hear.
I gave you the Parcells line. I think if I'm running in Las Vegas running a sports book, I want a ton of Bill Parcells's betting with me because I think your record is, you know, some sort of where you happen to be in this simulation of, you know, what could have happened many other instances. And I think what is really confused from last year, the Giants took a team that was basically overshadowed by an dysfunctional, incompetent narcissist in the front office who failed at his mandate of letting the players play and the coaches coach. And all of a sudden they were playing football and they started punching above their weight class and they regularly knocked people out above their weight class. And I think that there's a large contingent that's confused that success, which merits them a lot of credit with now the Giants have elevated into another weight class. I don't think that's happened yet. Frankly, I don't have your optimism that I heard you on today's podcast. I think that this is going to be a better team than last year, but I don't think this team is going to produce the same results as last year because I think last year, you know, we'd be in 15%, you know, win probability situations, and Lamar Jackson would fumble, or Travis Etienne would drop the ball on the goal line, or Vrabel would stop calling plays, and we'd, you know, and they'd miss a makeable field goal at the end of the game.
Yeah, that happens every year with incompetent teams. People do
sure, but at the shit. But the rate that it happened with the Giants was very high.
Bliss, an NFL data scientist, posted something like in week 6, and the Giants were like had like twice as many expected wins due to the other team's luck, you know, when they're dropping balls, when they're missing field goals, stuff outside of really the Giants' control, as you know. And I'm not, nobody's going to complain about that. I mean, how many times did we get bit?
Exactly. Know, it was not, it's not called, call it karma.
For years. But we have to realize that last year was in the above 90th percentile of outcomes. Not to mention now, you know, a year of Jones with Kafka is on film, and that teams are probably going to be anticipate some of the ways that we've had success against them. So I'd say, you know, I would say that our power ranking is going to be better. The quality of football will be better, but I think we're going to take a step back. And I think that that's healthy. Like Ethan said, you know, if we're year three, last year, we didn't even really have room to, like, you know, last year was like being parallel parked and not being able to move forward or back just because the cap was so tight. As you guys know, we couldn't even cut Kenny Golladay because it would, you know, cost more than it would save.
My dad said that they were an expansion team last year. I mean, the quarterback was a cap, was essentially, you know,
I've like, never seen an expansion team with that much dead money.
Well, it's, in terms of talent, like they were just picking up guys off the street. And they were just putting him in there. But
well, at least they had room, unlike in 2021 when they couldn't even field 53 guys because you know, we'd spent all
they were restructuring the kicker. Rudolph.
Yeah. I think
they were restructuring the kicker.
They exhausted. Are they a playoff team next year?
So, and then the other side of that, and I think somebody had said this to me and I thought it was really astute. I think Shane recognizes that we're in a down NFC. I mean, you guys were talking about like the three teams that are definitively better than we are. Maybe the Seahawks too. The Lions could be up there. The, you know, the Vikings could be, you know, who knows? You know, the teams get better, teams get, you know, teams get worse. But there aren't that many teams that are definitively above us. And then to the point, you know, the training for Darren Waller, keeping Daniel Jones and paying him a real starting QB salary instead of just taking a downgrade at the position and kind of retooling for the future year. These are moves of saying we want to make the playoffs now. We don't want to just get beat up by Dallas and Philly until you know, we finally get Caleb Williams or Arch Manning or whoever that might be, the dream scenario down the road. So, you know, I think that's, you know, we could go 7-10, we could go 9-8, we could go 11-6, but I think what I want to see more is what's Evan Neal doing, what's Daniel Jones doing, what Kayvon Thibodeau is doing.
You brought up that point about the weak NFC, and I want to compare it to the NBA for a second. When LeBron James was in Cleveland for those, or when he was in the Eastern Conference, every team was sort of like, oh, we're going to rebuild. We have no shot. When in reality, it's you, if you make one or two moves or if you do one or two things, you know, shit happens. You know, the NBA is a long season. And if you get to the Eastern Conference Finals, it's only one team you're chasing, right? Because it was the Miami Heat or the Cleveland Cavaliers and everybody else. And so I always said, specifically to Danny Ainge when he was hoarding all those draft picks, I said, dude, you're close. Like, make the move. Like, go out and get a superstar. Like, your roster has a lot of good players. Go get a couple of great players. And it was always like, no. You know, we're going to just wait out LeBron and whenever he leaves, and he eventually left. And then we saw the Toronto Raptors, who made that one move, win an NBA championship, right? So I sort of look at the NFC that way, but it's not like there's like this immovable force, standing in the way. Yes, the Philadelphia Eagles are extremely talented. Yes, they were in their Super Bowl last year. Yes, they have an incredibly talented roster. Yes, the Giants haven't beaten them much, but them, the Cowboys, and the 49ers, if the Giants were to make the playoffs, more likely than not, they only have to beat two of those teams to get to the Super Bowl. They don't have to beat all three. So my next question is, how far are they from Dallas? Well, the Giants got better, right? I think they have better coaching than the Cowboys. The Cowboys got better, but how far off are they? And that's my thing is, shit happens in the NFL. Guys get hurt, guys break out. We've seen it. Every year we see it. Like, there's one team that just, you know, breaks out. Like, I'm sure a year ago, nobody actually, well, they thought Philadelphia was going to be really good, but not as great as they were. So my question is, you can sit here and say, well, You got to follow the timeline. You got to follow the timeline. But you're in an incredible situation. There are only three teams in the NFC that you can undisputedly say are better than the Giants. And is this the time where you can the Giants sort of expedite this thing a little bit, especially if they have a conviction with the quarterback? And that's why I think, you know what, it's okay to rush the timeline if you're not jeopardizing the future, if you're not going out and trading draft picks for, you know, expensive veteran guys. So I guess that's where my thing
but
is.
I think that's the beauty of the NFL, right? We see high profile, big time position players get moved for way less than you would see in the NBA, right? Like in the NBA, if a star power forward is getting traded, you see a team giving up fucking a bunch of middle schoolers. They're like, you know, here's five firsts, including a 2030 first.
But who cares if you're trying to win a championship? Who cares? I thought my Toronto.
Point, that's not my point. My point is though, it's way easier to do in the NFL without sacrificing your future. So to get a Darren Waller for as little as they did, fine, go ahead and do it. You didn't have any good pass catchers. I don't think he makes you a contender, but he makes your team better. Bobby it's not Okereke. By the way,
Okereke, right?
I don't care. Ryan Dizdier just subtweeted us, by the way, on the Bobby O pronunciation. It's Okereke. Okereke. Bobby
O.
Yeah. Bobby Okereke. I'm not going to remember that. Going out and signing Bobby O, like, they didn't have any linebackers. I don't even consider that, like, yeah, it has to be a compete now mode, if I'm using your terminology, wise, because it's literally like signing a majority of those free agents would have been an upgrade to what they currently had on the roster.
Let me give you, I'll give it to you, Will. When you look at the AFC, there's about, like, if you were to rank the top 10 quarterbacks, how many of them play in the AFC? Like seven, right?
Well, I would agree with Weiss that I'd rather have Aaron Rodgers than Jalen Hurts, by the way. But I would say...
That's why I like you, Will. These people, they just live in...
You know, I would say I'd start with Mahomes, obviously.
Yes.
Josh Allen and Joe Burrow right at the top. Mm-hmm. Lamar Jackson, Justin Herbert are probably right there.
Trevor Lawrence.
Trevor Lawrence would be my next one that I'd put in right there. And then...
Jalen Hurts and Dak Prescott are the only two that are... Well, Jalen Hurts is a top 10 quarterback. I'll give you that.
I would actually I think Daniel Jones and Dak are neck and neck. I think that they and I've always been higher on Daniel Jones than a lot of at least when I say always, since the week one of preseason in 2019 when I did my 1 year than a lot of Giants Nation. But no, to your point entirely, I think they're a real case, like you guys framed a really interesting question in your last podcast about, you know, you flop Sirianni and Hurts with Jones and Dable. Where I think what is also really interesting is you swap Jones with Tua, because the narrative that's really been discussed, like, Jones was very clearly dealt a really, really bad hand, not only last year with his weapons, but his entire career with his weapons, with his line, with his coaching staff, with the mandate of, you know, of not everybody being aligned. He's done quite a lot, in my opinion, with very little. But I don't think doing a lot with very little means necessarily that you're the guy who can maximize having a lot. I think that's a really different skill set. And I think,
explain that. Why do you think he can't do if you give him better
it's
pieces?
The reason that I said yesterday with Jalen Hurts, just because you surround someone with a shitload of weapons and a good offensive line doesn't mean they're always going to perform.
It's a difference basically between reacting and panicking and being able to do something out of that, and being able to, when everything's perfect, take your time. It's just a totally different skill set. It's
But listen to what Will said. Will said that he thought Daniel Jones did a lot with less, with not a lot. It was a tough situation, and Will said he thought he showed a lot. So my question is, why don't you guys think he can do a lot if he's given a better environment? Like, why is there this notion that there's no, that the ceiling can't go up for Daniel Jones?
That's not what I'm saying, Weiss. What I'm saying is basically, if Daniel, for the sake of argument, Daniel yes. Jones, let's say he's in the, he did a 90th percentile job of what quarterbacks would be able to do in his situation, just right. for the sake of argument. And I think there could be a chance that he might be only able to only do a 50th percentile job in a very, very good situation. Now, that 50th percentile job in a very, very good situation
still
is
better,
a better
than 98.
And a better overall performance than a 95th percentile job in a worse situation. But I'm just saying that some quarterbacks might be a more irreplaceable with a very, very talented supporting cast, and some might be really, really, and that's what he had to do at Duke. You know, like I don't necessarily know if him keeping Duke's floor up meant that he would have taken Ohio State or Alabama to the top.
I guess my only thing is, can you give me an example of a quarterback like that who played well when surroundings was bad, very bad, got good individual achievements, and then you also got the team achieved a lot, and then all of a sudden the team got better and he did.
Would you make that argument for Ryan Tannehill? Miami, they were dog shit, bad coaching.
But I thought he was the same quarterback throughout his career.
He's been far better at Tennessee, and especially in his earlier years, he had a much better supporting cast than he did Miami, and he improved. But at some point,
Did you see what you just said? He had a good supporting cast in Miami.
I said the opposite. I said he didn't have a good supporting cast in Miami. He had a good supporting cast when he went to Tennessee, and Tennessee is still yet to get over the hump, and people just consider him to still be like an average guy, even though he improved in a better situation.
The situation in Miami
How about Kyler Murray?
Well, Kyler Murray has other issues that are not just his on-field
play. Guy plays more Call of Duty than I do.
Yeah, there's different situations.
So in the NFL, maybe not, because I don't think that they're, not off the top of my head at least, but like
in the NBA, they had to put a clause in Kyler Murray's contract for him to watch film. I don't think the Giants have to do that with Daniel Jones.
No doubt.
Right? So Tannehill.
Okay. They might have to put a BAC clause in his contract.
I've heard some of those myself. But if anybody can handle it, it's not like he's Kyle Lauletta,
So I guess, Will, do you think Daniel Jones has reached a ceiling, or is there more to this?
So I love the way that you asked that question, because I think I was there. The narrative of between 2021 and 2022 was Daniel Jones showed so much more. And I kind of rejected that narrative because I felt like he had a much better situation, obviously, most of all the Mike Kafka upgrade from Jason Garrett. I mean, and then Jason Garrett, being replaced on a 6-day bye week, which is, I think, one of the most short-sighted reactive symptoms of a dysfunctional regime. But his life was
that was one of the scoopage I got right, man. I'll never forget that morning on Monday night. Got a text, hey, if this is embarrassing, Garrett's gone. But go ahead, sorry.
How do you do? You have a full bye week. You have an extra bye week because it's a Monday night game. You have 15 days. You could make a proactive change and then say, no, we'll see what he can do against a defending Super Bowl champion. And if that doesn't work out, then we'll really, pull the plug. It's maddening. But so I think what we saw last year was basically more of like the chains being off than necessarily like these new talents that hadn't necessarily been seen. And I think obviously with a more capable weapons around him, I mean, like a Darren Waller, who is a more refined Evan Engram. I mean, he's what people hoped Evan Engram were going to be. At least when he's healthy, that's what he's shown so far in his career. If Jones can find ways to make Waller look better, if Jones can find some of these speedy receivers, whoever's going to end up making the team. By the way, I kind of have this weird feeling that Jaden Mickens is going to be in the mix because he's a returner. I don't think a lot of people are mentioning him, but he's my one of my dark horses for the 53. But there are things that Jones hasn't shown us. You may remember I said this to you, I think when you had me on in 2021. Through 4 years, I mean, obviously through 4 years, it's a little tougher now than maybe at least through 3.5 years. Jones has shown me a lot more than Eli did at this stage in his development. Obviously, at the end of his fourth year, Eli, had that unforgettable special run that's changed my life forever. But Jones has shown me more just in terms of raw ability than I really thought I ever saw from Eli. Now, whether he has that it factor, whether he can scare defense and basically make them think, wow, Daniel Jones had the ball for 3 seconds. We are toast. Like, he hasn't taken that step yet, but he hasn't really had the situation where he could take that step yet. And hopefully that's the unknown that I think this year is going to solve. And for what it's worth, he's earned the right to kind of take his best to swing at solving that unknown before we move on, because he's done a lot in a terrible, terrible situation.
I've been taking notes while, I don't know, you can't see them, but while you've been talking about things.
Ranting?
No, I wouldn't call it a rant. It was very insightful stuff. I mean, look, I don't, the way I view the 2022 Giants is a little different than the way you guys view them. I actually think they can. It's more likely that they take another step forward than they take a step back. And it's there's a lot of things involved in that.
Yeah, but I think the number one thing involved in your, I'll call it hope, is the fact that it's I don't want to say primarily, because I feel like you'll just disagree, but I think it's primarily based on what you perceive to be a very weak NFC. And I think if the Giants were to compete because of a weak NFC, that's fine. Like, you can't fault them for that, right? It's like you play your schedule, right? That's just the division they're in. They're lucky that they're not in the AFC quarterback West. Gauntlet of the AFC, right? Like, you just play your schedule, you play your division. It's a weak division. If they play well and they beat up on some people and they get in, that's fantastic. But I assume Will agrees, will not be judging this season's success on whether or not they make the playoffs or how deep of a run they make in the playoffs. It's going to be more about individual growth across the roster, given how young a lot of these players are.
Well, I'll say this. If their key players, their quarterback, if he visibly, obviously takes a step back, that's pretty concerning.
Of course.
Right? You want to show you – the commitment they made to Daniel Jones is a commitment that doesn't tell me that they think that they're okay with his level of play. They think he can be better. Am I right, Will? Like you said, you don't pay a guy
– You pay for future. Is. Future
pay for the future, right? So he certainly in the past wasn't a $40 million quarterback, even though he had a very good year.
Let's add one kind of layer to this also. Remember, they paid Daniel Jones after declining his option last year, and knowing correct. That there was egg on their face from kind of overpaying from what they would have had. You know, it's the opposite of the, our favorite running backs negotiations from the bye week.
It right. really is.
Right.
And I think
they could have said, hey. I just
want to say that the whole situation with the running back really emphasized, in my opinion, that this was Shane saying, I want this guy, not, okay, we're stuck with him, like, because that's what I've been told to do. So to your point, yeah, I think that they're saying that we are lucky to have Daniel Jones on our team, but with the deal that he has, and we're going to keep it that way.
And that's why I think the NFC being weak is a factor. Obviously, I mean, if this was the AFC, I wouldn't have the same optimism, because it is a quarterback driven league. And if Daniel Jones was in the AFC, he would not be anywhere near those top tier quarterbacks. But because it's the AFC, because you mentioned the gap between him and Dak is close, or there is no gap, they're the same. I mean, the 49ers, great team, but this is a quarterback league. Like,
I was speaking about the 49ers earlier today. Sorry to just go off on a tangent in the middle of your point.
Yeah.
I really like Shanahan. I like a lot of players on that team. I like CMC. I like Debo.
Easy guys to root for.
I like Ayuk. Right. There's very few guys that are not likable on that roster.
You got to love CMC when, the Panthers are still paying like a third of his contract.
Yeah. So I just – as an NFC fan, this shouldn't pain me. It really pains me to see a coaching staff and a roster as talented as that be so complacent to run it back with the quarterback room that they have. Because I understand it's like, listen, we don't need a star for this team to really succeed. Like, we don't need our quarterback to be the engine, and that's a rarity in today's NFL. But it's the same time, it's like, you can't tell me a guy as smart as Shanahan doesn't understand the importance of throwing the ball downfield and explosive plays. And it's like, man, if they had even a top 15 quarterback, they would be Super Bowl favorites. And I just don't understand the complacency to run it back with Brock Purdy, Trey Lance, who I loved but hasn't even gotten like first team work. Like, what are they doing, man? I don't know. Like, they'll still be a very good team, and they scheme better than anyone. But the fact that they just, yeah, Brock Purdy off Tommy John, run it back. That's just perplexing to me.
You know, I'm not saying that this to refute your point, but just to, you know, to complete the thought, they did bring in Sam Darnold, but
okay.
Ooh, yeah. We're with the Vipers.
So because of those things, I choose to be optimistic.
So,
they brought back Saquon Barkley's happy with his $900,000 incentive.
That's what really counts. I love that you're going through all the reasons and you don't even mention our former Pro Bowl long snapper. But so, you know, there's a point that I read in or actually listened to in an audiobook, Annie Duke's Making Smarter Bets recently. And I think I couldn't really recommend it higher enough, more strongly. You know what I'm trying to say. Especially
highly recommend.
Highly recommend. Couldn't. Yeah, exactly. Appreciate the help. You know, it's a two-man job. In terms of evaluating decisions, the coaching staff decisions of the Giants significantly improved. But in 2022, the theme wasn't necessarily that the coaching staff decisions improved. It was that the results of improved coaching staff decisions were consistently better. Like, there could be a situation where it's objectively better to go for two than to go for one, but you could go for two and miss it, and it's still the right call, and that would have hurt you more than had you done the wrong thing.
It's about the process, what you're basically saying.
Process over results, and that very rarely happened. And I see people, like, you know, we're talking about the Giants kind of maybe being overmatched personnel, and they're like, well, they've got a coaching advantage, so, you know, they'll be okay. And just kind of, where I get concerned is basically assuming that where there's an improvement, Darren Waller, Bobby O, you know, we're expecting tangible progress there. But then when we had something that went as well as possible, not necessarily we're saying we're not considering or we're dismissing, but I think we're underestimating a little bit of regression there makes a big deal. In my opinion, one of the biggest differences between 2015 and 2016 was in 2015, it felt like every fourth down went wrong. And in 2016, every fourth down went right. And that was
2015. Yeah. Oh,
2015 was the year that we were 6-10 that year.
Right.
Like the offense was great. We kept losing it like in the last 2 minutes.
Right.
That
Patriot game where Landon Collins drops that pick.
Patriots, you know, the Cowboys week one. I mean, there were
Washington in that game. Yeah.
I mean, that year still gives me nightmares. But, and then 2016, like everything went right. It would be fourth and one. And I think, was it the Odell over Malcolm Butler on fourth down? I don't remember. But,
yes, that was the one. Yeah. That was that year.
Was that on a fourth down play? Like,
third down, I think, because
it might have been. But that those margin of error is what's really small. And that's the real difference between the NBA and the NFL. You know, you get a 7-game series, you get 48 minutes, you get so many the volatility of discrete events is so minimal compared to what happens in the NFL. You know, you could be a huge favorite, a weird drop off of Evan Ingram's hands, and all of a sudden you're down by seven. And so I think there's certainly reasons to be optimistic. Like, you know, I felt like last year was a wasted season before it started. I think there are a lot of ways that I was proven wrong. And then I think also the way that we couldn't really stand up to Dallas and Philadelphia means it's not completely wrong. But I don't think like this year it makes sense to go in and say this is a wasted season, it's not worth playing or anything like that. There's certainly a chance that the Giants can, you know, repeat what last year does. But I think that mean expectation should be a little more conservative. And I think, like, I don't think there are many teams that we don't have a chance against, but I don't think that there are many teams that don't have a chance against us.
So answer me this. My I don't want to say it. My expectation is to make the playoffs. My ceiling, where I think this is where they'll max out, is the divisional round. Again, my floor is obviously missing the playoffs and, you know, whatever. Are those reasonable expectations, or are those, am I being unreasonable? Because to me, I think it's reasonable.
I think those are very aggressive. I think, I wouldn't say unreasonable, because I think that, you know, that you're, I think if you asked John Mara, he would probably say the same thing. I mean, that, but then again, he said that going into 2019. So, maybe it's not necessarily reasonable, but, I would say, you know, obviously making the playoffs, you know, their teams are level or worse in the NFC that we're going to be fighting for a wild card against. We're going to have to play two of the best teams in the league combined in the conference four times. No other team is going to really have to do that. So that, you know, there is a little adversity, obviously, but I don't think you're being unreasonable is the point I'm making, but I'm more inclined to be on where to approach things where Ethan's coming from and say, I want to see the way we're playing the games. I want to see us competing for fourth quarters. I want to see big growth from some of the real premium, you know, Joe Shane investments. Really, one of those. I'm starting to get more and more concerned about Wandale. I think, I mean, obviously, every other slot receiver in the NFL now is on the Giants roster, and it's. I think if they were as high on Wandale as they were in April of 2022, that probably wouldn't be the case. Obviously, there.
Well, I don't think Paris Campbell's a true slot guy. And Sterling Shepard has got his own injury issues, and Cole Beasley's a camp body. Like, I don't think that's at all an indictment on Wandale. I mean, when he was finally healthy and getting, you know, a good amount of reps in the middle of the season, he was eating. And yeah, you could argue that that's more a result of, well, who else is there, you know, right place, right time for him. But to be selected as highly as he was in the first draft of a new regime, I personally have high hopes for him. One other point I'd like to make is I really think that a lot of Giants fans, and we'll do this when we get to the season preview, are underestimating how tough the Giants schedule is, especially in the first half. You know, it's not easy. Like, they have the Cowboys, who we've heaped praise on the last two episodes, the Cardinals, you know, whatever. They got the 49ers, the Seahawks are sort of a question mark. The Dolphins are going to be a question mark. They got the Bills, the Aaron Rodgers, Jets. I think the Commanders are going to stink. I think the Raiders are a question mark. Like, there's just a lot of what ifs on the schedule that I think could go one way or the other based on how these other teams perform. And we see it every year. Like, we go into the season like, you know, this team's going to stink. And at the bye week, they're 6-2. So, like, I don't know. I think that there are just so many factors at play here that it would be foolish of me to say, yes, like, the Giants will definitively win these games. They're definitely going to make the playoffs. And I think in year two, it's just so much easier to care about the little things and doing things the right way in year two.
But you guys say, I'm more focused on, you know, the young guys getting better. I'm more focused on seeing if the quarterback can do this.
I already know what you're going to say. You're going to say that in order for the Giants to do what you're saying they're going to do, they need that improvement from those young guys in order to hit your floor or reach the ceiling that you're talking about.
Well, yeah. I mean, if these things happen, right, like you guys hope that they happen.
Of course, but that those same things could also happen to these other teams that they're going to play. So there's just, listen, that's why we play the games, right? Any given Sunday.
I want to go back to the running back for a second, because I know this is a running back discussion.
And we sort of went. And we're also running long. Let's try to wrap it up soon.
Will, I want to ask you one question, and you can answer it however way you want to answer it. When is it okay for a team to commit to a running back?
That's a great question.
Because really I'm one of those people that say every situation is different. If you're a team that's rebuilding, it's probably not smart to use a number two pick on a running back. But if you're a team that's, you know, has a franchise quarterback, is one of the elite teams, you know, you have that luxury of saying, hey, this guy we really like, we're going to take him, or this guy is really good, we're going to pay him, you know, give him a contract. But my question is, when is that scenario okay in your mind?
And we're defining commit as like make a multi-year
commitment. Multi-year agreement, $12 million. What the look at what the Giants offered him, right? 3 years, 4 years, $12 million a year, 2 years of a guaranteed. You know, these this I'm not talking like 5 years, you know, Christian McCaffrey. I'm talking, you know, what you sort of see was thrown around for Saquon this year.
I thought the Browns handled Nick Chubb really well. Is something that would come up. I think the way that they got in front of the rookie contract expiring, I think, you know, that created goodwill from his perspective, because obviously his rookie deal was a below market deal, not, you know, one of the highest guaranteed deals of all time, you know, due to where he was drafted, unlike, you know, somebody else in a draft class. By the way, I think our running back is more talented than Nick Chubb. But I think Nick Chubb, you know, will produce more than he will just because of the situation that he's been in. So, like, you know, I saw that our guy was ranked, you know, a tier below him. That's totally independent from, you know, whether or not I think it makes sense to prioritize having that person on the roster. But I think, you know, I think it the way that I would answer it is it just is not necessarily when in like a team's timeline. It's when in the order of operations of looking at a roster. If you feel comfortable with the quarterback, if you know that financially you'll be able to take care of other players at important positions in future years, and you're not going to be having to extend your kicker, you know, restructure your kicker to, you know, fill out your roster. If you've got your, you know, CB1, if you've got an edge, if you've got a line that makes sense. Obviously, you know, one of the reasons I was so opposed the pick in the first place is because everybody and their brother knew that the Giants had to rebuild the line, and we had a golden opportunity to acquire the very picks that a reasonable GM would have used to build the line. So, you know, the way that the Cowboys drafted Zeke, I think that was a terrible draft pick, but it was less egregious because they gave him a line to run behind. So there are some ways that it does make sense, but I just think the trend in the NFL is you don't want to have one guy, and the Giants fell to the trap of our one guy was so athletic and so talented that it almost became worse because it was like a, you know, it was drawing these negative EPA plays just to give him touches. You know, we're talking about the 65 catches. I'm sure that 1 year he got it was 2018. I remember week two. I think I have it burned into my mind. I think it was 14 catches for 99 yards against Dallas. They kept throwing it to him on like 3rd and 12, you know, yeah, 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage. What were we doing? Yeah. You know, we got beat by Tavon Austin to start that game. But so I think, you know, it's never okay to build an offense around a running back. You know, that will always, you know, the more you ask him to, you know, hold up to be Atlas, the more he's going to crumble. But if he can be spelled, if there's a system where he can succeed, then sure, you can, you know, make sure that you get one of the elite talents. And then I think, you know, I think, like, as I said about the Browns, spelling him with a guy like Kareem Chubb will ensure that, you know, he'll be able to produce throughout that duration.
Kareem Hunt, yeah, which was still a free agent, by the way. Okay. I mean, are you excited for – would you draft Saquon Barkley in your fantasy team, on your fantasy team?
I have never placed a bid on him in any league, just out of principle from the draft.
Do you have some over-unders I could throw at him real quick about Saquon, Ethan? And you're a big gambling guy.
I don't. Well, I don't know what his lines are.
Yeah, I would say and I find like over-unders on player props for the most part, you know, preseason. I'm not super excited about some of that. I think the ones that are more exciting, like on the team, were like, frankly, over-unders of how many games Waller will play. And I did want to comment on the Waller thing, because I'm not as I don't see it as much of a win now move. I thought the Waller trade was more about the Raiders selling him than the Giants buying him. And I think the contract's very easy to get out of. And I basically see any contributions we get from Waller as a bonus. That might be a little bit of a stretch, but I think I think that they made the trade knowing that there was a good chance that he wouldn't be able to stay healthy. And and Waller knows that too. At the Giants season ticket holder town hall, Waller said, you know, for his goal for the year, it's to play every game. So so we'll see what happens. But I think, you know, the Giants could easily decide to move on from him next year, and that wouldn't necessarily be an indictment of the trade at all.
It's compete now move, sort of like what they did with the quarterback.
And on that note, I'm sorry, but the wide receiver who is similar in size to Wandale, who is recently with the Giants, who is now in Kansas City.
Richie James.
Why on earth?
Are you talking about Richie James, or are you talking about Kadarius Toney?
I'm talking about the Gator, but I like the way you said that.
All right.
But I don't understand why these Giants fans, and I think it started with, you know, Joe Shane's despicable predecessor, you know, in the way he kind of talked about the Odell deal, but why it's like another team has to lose a trade for us to feel like we won the trade. Like, that was so clearly, unambiguously a win trade.
Well, I want to defend them a little bit. I do agree sometimes it's kind of weird, but I mean, the guy kind of pokes the bear a lot.
I mean, well, he pokes the bear, but like, it doesn't take a genius to figure out what's going on. Like, this guy grew up as a super athlete. Like, you know, he was the most athletic guy in any field he ever was. He went to a team. They said, yeah, okay, we don't need you. You're not here to help us, you know, thanks, but no thanks. He was pissed off about that. He got traded. He's pissed off. You know, he's pissed off that we felt that he didn't need, you know, he got the number tattooed on his back. First of all, you may have heard my argument that the whole tenure was really because he was given the wrong jersey number. But, you know, he's pissed off that the Giants aren't like, man, he's the one who got away. And he's lashing out because he's insecure about that. It's from a position of weakness. Like, you know, wash your hands and move on. Say thanks, you know, thanks for, you know, what you did.
Yeah, but it's a two-way street. The people that are lashing out are also have some weaknesses to them too. Like, I'm a weak guy. I couldn't resist when he got hurt on the first day of training camp. I'm petty too a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, one more question. I'll let you go. What is more likely to happen? A running back breaks Emmitt Smith's rushing record at 18,355, or RFK becomes the president at some point in our lifetime?
RFK, I'm going to go with RFK breaks the 18,000 record. You saw him do those push-ups a few weeks ago?
See, he's always doing that shit. Will, you going to be at training camp?
I might just end up seeing you. I think our days may be aligned. I'd love to.
I want to buy you guys dinner. I want to wine and dine you guys.
Well, now I got to go.
You know, I really like the hot dog.
I hate hot dogs.
I heard. You know how they're made?
Yeah, he's aware.
All right, take us home, boys.
All right, follow us on Twitter. You know the deal. I'm not even going to bother with the housekeeping. Fun bonus episode, and we'll talk to you guys after a few days of camp.
Peace.
Shout out, producer Nick. We missed you.